I think I look forward to plays by Richard Bean with more enthusiasm than those of anybody else around. That's partly because maybe we see things in the same way, partly because I just know that I will have a good laugh, I will think deeply about life in strange ways, and have a thoroughly good night in a theatre. He's been writing prolifically since he started in theatre and appeared... There must be very few theatres that you haven't actually appeared in, Richard. So, first of all, welcome to Theatre Voice.
Yes, hi. Hello.
The latest theatre that you're about to appear in is the National Theatre, which obviously is a major achievement in career terms.
Playing for England.
Playing for England, exactly.
Well, it's an analogy.
It is. And the play that you are doing for England is actually, it started off being Italian, a Commedia dell'arte play, normally known as A Servant to Two Masters. And your take on that is One Man, Two Governors. And that one, I take it the one man is James Corden.
Oh, yes. There's only one James Corden.
There's only one James Corden, and the one James Corden will be appearing on the national stage. It's already in previews, I think.
Yeah, we had the first preview last night, yeah.
Generally speaking, you've written plays about subjects that interested you, possibly where they've been connected to your background. Taking something from the Commedia tradition and developing it as a Richard Bean play is probably a new kind of a venture for you. Is that fair?
Well, the One Man, Two Governors, Servant to Two Masters thing, it basically, the motivation for that came from Nick Heitner at the National, really, because... I guess every year Nick wants to do a play on one of the big stages, i.e. Little Samuel of the Olivia, which is pure entertainment. It's not necessarily from the classical tradition, or it's not necessarily a classic, I should say, but it has no pretensions to philosophy or an understanding of the human condition. Are you with me?
I'm with you entirely.
It's let me try to think of some examples from the past seasons, if you like. So, I mean, something like London Assurance is a very good example. We did that last year. I say we did that. Well, of course, it's a Don Busico play, London Assurance. But Nick called me in to use his phrase, to goose it up. I don't really know what goosing it up means, but...
You certainly succeeded in doing it, whatever it means.
Yeah, basically, Nick and I sat down and we chopped the script about quite a lot and cut... we're talking about London Assurance still now. A great deal, and I put... I goosed it up. I suppose I used comedy craft skills to even out what is in truth. If you are mad enough to want to... spend an afternoon reading the original Don Busico play, London Assurance, you'll find that it's really very uneven. You can read for 10 minutes and there's not a laugh, and then there's 15 laughs on one page.
Well, I think he wrote it in his early 20s, didn't he? So not a mature playwright at the time.
Well, I think he probably stole it in his early 20s because he was a bit of a bodger, I think. And, there's a lot of stories about Don Busico. He's a bit of a rake. I think he was a bigamist. He possibly murdered his first wife, didn't he? And I think he did. He was a consummate plagiarist as well. There's a comedy tradition of plagiarism, of course, because comedy is so demanding that in the end, people are often tempted to nick. If you look at the kind of old-fashioned comedy club circuit, they all do each other's material.
There's plagiarism, and then there are revivals or rewritings, and that's where you're going to this time around, because it's by Carlo Goldoni from, as I say, an Italian tradition long, long ago, and turning it into something presumably completely new.
Yeah, I mean, there's no moral connection between plagiarism and doing a version. I wasn't ploughing that furrow. This is Carlo Goldoni. Yeah, you're right. 1760 something, I think it was. And it's irregular. You know, it's a bit of a banker in the sense that
I can remember a fantastic performance that I think was under the auspices of the RSC at the Young Vic with Jason Watkins in. It was just unforgettable.
The Lee Hall version. Yeah.
Yes.
That's right. Yeah. No, I didn't see that. I mean, I've read Lee's version of it. I mean, you know, if you get it right, it works as a play because it's extremely daft.
plot. It's got enough farce elements to keep tickling the audience with a laugh in the way that a farce can, you know, doors and running and whatever.
Yeah, it's a bit of a gift, and I quite enjoy doing versions because it, what it does, if you're a writer, it's quite nice to do a version once a year, because you get up in the morning and you don't have the pain of writing, because the real pain of writing is thinking of what happens next in your own play. What happens next? And of course, when you're doing a version, essentially what happens next has already been decided for you, so you can concentrate on the dialogue and the lines and trying to make the damn thing work. But to get up in the morning and work on a version is a little bit of a vocational holiday, if you like.
It's a little bit easier than exorcising your demons, which probably will send us all mad in the end. So to do 2 or 3 original plays a year is pretty damn hard work, but to do a version in the middle is pays the bills, keeps you sane.
250 years ago, this would have been done on the basis that Goldoni would have created the characters, written a little bit of it, and just said, do your bit, lads, or lads and lasses. Well, to what extent are you just leaving James Corden to do whatever he wants, and how much are you writing the script?
Yeah, that's not really my understanding of Commedia. I may not be right, I'm not a theatrical historian, but essentially Commedia did have these stock characters and troops of actors would go around the market towns and whatever and set up the stage in the market, and they would have a scenario for a plot, but essentially each actor had their own personal stock character, and the play would be essentially, as you said, improvised. My understanding of what Goldoni did is that he came because
he was kind of the crossover, wasn't he?
Well, no, I think from what I've read, he came along, saw Commedia in Italy getting really vulgar in the marketplace. You can imagine, I mean, you know, there is a mask in one of the stock characters in Commedia, has a mask with essentially a phallus on it, the nose is a penis. And now, if you're playing close up in a market situation, you can imagine how vulgar that's. That's going to get. And Goldoni, my understanding is, don't quote me on this, but you can listen and Google it. Try and find the truth. My understanding is that Goldoni was ashamed of the Italian culture. Well, not that it was unified then, but Italian culture becoming more base than French culture. So he thought, I'm going to write the scenario, I'm going to write the dialogue, and I'm going to clean it up, and I'm going to do a bit of quality control and whatever. Goldoni is often accused of killing Commedia because of that, because Commedia is not a text-based theatre form. So if there is a text, then it ain't Commedia, is it? So, yeah, Goldoni is often accused of killing Commedia. I don't know whether that answered your question.
I think I got fairly close to it. And what about working at the National? It must be a special experience because it is our own theatre, it's the National Theatre. Last time out, you had a very interesting experience there with England People, very nice. Or last time, with, I think that was your last big original play there, which was a big, ambitious play, I think a monstrous play, I can probably safely say, about the history of London, the history of incomers, and it created a remarkable amount of controversy that I imagine hadn't even occurred to you when you were writing it.
Well, I mean, I think when I was writing England People Very Nice, I knew that it would ruffle a few feathers. But I don't know how much controversy there was. I mean, we live in a media world, don't we? So if there's something going on in the media, it doesn't mean to say that it's going on in the world. Does that make sense?
It makes absolute sense.
It's going on in the media. Mm. And what controversy was there? There was one nutter from Bethnal Green who organised a campaign, managed to raise his brother-in-law, a pal from the pub, and it was the same 5 or 6 people standing outside with the same placard.
And one or two newspapers with agendas possibly getting interested in it.
Well, The Guardian apparently was told this by one of the Guardian journalists who was sent to a preview. And I think it was a preview, I can't be sure about that. But this Guardian journalist told me that The Guardian sent 12 journalists to a preview. And of those 12, 10 walked out at the interval. So if that ain't an agenda, I don't know what is.
If that's what The Guardian was doing, well, that's the thing, what one or two of the other papers might have been thinking about.
Yeah, I don't, I mean, it's interesting, people always talk about the controversy around England People Very Nice. As far as I'm concerned, there was no real controversy. There was an orchestrated campaign against it by, as I say, The Guardian, and there was this guy in Bethnal Green who... I don't know, it was a weird thing. I couldn't work out what his objections to it were. Certainly not, they didn't come from an Islamic point of view. They didn't come from a religious point of view. Absolutely not. My understanding of him, he was a kind of secular Muslim, a Bengali. And I think he simply considered that the play, that it was racist. And he couldn't get beyond the theatrical conceit, the theatrical technique of you know, the asylum seeker centre staging the play, the play within the play. Quite obviously, everybody was stereotyped in the play, so quite obviously it was a play about stereotyping and how it works, how stereotyping works. You know, if one Irish family has a pig in the flat, then all Irish families have pigs in the flat.
I think if you were going to cause offence, and I'm not convinced that it should have done, it was going to cause offence to absolutely everybody on some grounds or other.
Well, I mean, I think that was part of the reason that Nick liked it. Nick, being Jewish, of course, he got me to rewrite the Jewish acts and said, I think you've been a bit soft, and, you know, let's even this up a bit. I mean, the French I stereotype the French, the Jewish immigration from the Pale, Bengali, and Irish, and of course the new waves coming in at the end, Somali, whatever. But I mean, obviously what I was trying to say, and what the play was trying to say, is this is a sociological process, immigration, and within three generations anybody's English. And that's all there was to it. And why the hell that's... Oh, I suppose it's a bit of an ask to put a hook-handed cleric on the stage, dribbling and foaming at the mouth, whatever. But I don't see anything particularly controversial about that. I mean, you know, the bad guys are the bad guys, aren't they? Can't we say the bad guys are the bad guys?
There's a question. I'm certainly not willing to answer it. let me take you way back, because your path into theatre was somewhat unorthodox, I think. Well, I'll say unique.
Well, yeah, perhaps. I mean, I'll try and be very brief on that. I mean, I had no particular ambitions to be a playwright.
Do you have any kind of family background in theatre?
No. My dad's a policeman, my mum's a hairdresser, and there's no one in the family with any theatrical links at all. I went to university, I studied psychology, I worked in industry as an occupational psychologist for, 15, 20 years or so. And then round about the mid-80s, I got interested in stand-up comedy. I would go to stand-up comedy clubs as a member of the audience. And of course, in those days, I haven't been for years, I don't know how it works now, but there was always an open mic, open mic spot, which, you know, an unpaid 5 minutes, so someone from get up from the audience, and a rookie, and try and do 5 minutes. And I did that one night, and it went very well. The guy asked me to do 10 minutes a couple of months later, and I did 10 minutes and it was terrible. And I thought, oh God, you've got to be serious about this. You've got to sit down and you've got to get a notebook and write some jokes. And so I did that. And then I did stand up for 3 years. And
were you still working as an occupational
psychologist? Yeah, but I was self-employed, so it felt like a very free and
I hesitate to use the phrase bohemian
lifestyle, but I wasn't working Monday to Friday 9 to 5. I was freelance occupational psychology, working mainly for charities, doing management recruitment, and you know, maybe I'd get 3 or 4 days work a month, and I'd charge a lot of money for it. And I'd live frugally, and when I wasn't working for those companies or charities, I'd be sitting writing jokes. And doing gigs in the evening, of course, which didn't earn much money, to be honest, but you know, but that got me writing. And of course, with the with alternative comedy, you're always writing your own material. You cannot. It's, you know, it's part of the culture of alternative comedy, or was. I have no idea what the current culture is. Then I fell into writing for the BBC, writing gags for the BBC. £60 a gag, you know, Radio 4 Light Entertainment. And I linked up with a couple of other writers there, Andy Clifford and Clive Coleman. And we wrote a sketch show for Radio BBC, and called Control Group 6, which had 2 series, and it was fun. I suppose that got me writing. Interest in theatre, very little, even at that point. Although we, the three of us, Control Group 6, we would perform our sketches in rooms above pubs and whatever.
And this was sort of mid-90s by then?
Yeah, it was about 1990, I think. I forget, but I would think it would be better that, yeah. And actually, the weird thing is, what got me interested in theatre was that I lodged with an actor for about 5 or 6 years. Didn't know him. I found a room through Time Out, and situation in my life would split up, and you know, I was finding somewhere to rest my head. And he was an actor, so I went to see him in the plays that he was in, and I kind of got reasonably interested, and I started playing for an actor's cricket team, which further deepened my interest in theatre, because you would go and see the members of the team in their plays, mainly actors. And I got interested in theatre that way. And then I wrote Toast, I suppose. I felt that I had a play in me, and Toast was basically autobiographical, about a year of my life when I was 18, when I worked in a mass production bread factory. So, I mean, Toast, as you know, is a night shift, 7 guys on a night shift. Very naturalistic, old-fashioned play for, what was that, 1999, wasn't it? You know, whenever it was, suppose it was the tail end of the in-your-face theatre, wasn't it?
Mm.
The tail end, and this 42-year-old bloke comes along with a naturalistic play. Who'd be interested in that?
And the answer was the Royal Court.
The Royal Court were interested, yeah. Well, actually, the National were. I mean, the people who opened the doors for that play were really at the National. And the Royal Court joined in, but the National discovered the play, if you like.
And how easy was it to place a play for a new playwright, or a new non-playwright, if you'll pardon me?
Yeah, yeah,
and to get a play produced is, well, it can't be unheard of because they do it, but the odds must be 1 in 100 for someone who's never written a play before to get that play produced on a decent professional stage, let alone Royal Court upstairs.
Yeah, let's talk about cricket, because that's probably got a little bit of influence in it. I was playing for, playing for the actors' cricket team. They're all doing plays, they're all talking about writing all the time, whatever. And, the scorer was Punny Morell, who runs the National Theatre Studio. She's the manager. She wasn't the manager then. She was the, I don't know, she worked in theatre. Can't remember what her job was specifically, but she was a reader at the National. You know, the National have a reading panel for new plays. So she would jog me every now and then at the cricket matches and say things like, haven't you written a play yet? Have you written that play yet? Why don't you write a play? You know, that kind of thing. I was also quite interested in writing for television, because I thought there was a lot of money in television. That's how naive I was. And I wanted to get, you know, something like write something for the Bill or something like that. And somebody also told me, well, you know, you get a play on at the Bush, the all of the audience at the Bush are television producers because it's just round the corner from, you know, whatever. So I sent Toast to the Bush and they weren't interested. I sent Toast to Northern Broadside, Barry Rutter. Oh, no, I didn't send the play. I sent him a letter and said, would you like to, because he's from Hull as well, I'm from Hull. And the bakery is in, you know, St. Hall, obviously. And I sent Barry a letter saying, I'm a new writer and I've written a play about Hull, your hometown, and would you be interested in reading it? And he wrote a postcard back, a postcard, not a letter, and it said, if it's about two tear asses in a flat, forget it. Barry. And so that was Barry Rutter's card. And... but yeah, I suppose the main thing is that the play ended up in the reading, on the table at the reading panel at the National. And Punny was very good about that. I think she tore the front page off, took my name away from it because a couple of... So I don't know, because she knew me or whatever, you know, there was some, she was trying to make the process democratic anyway. And a guy called Will Curley, who ended up directing The Godbotherers. Did you see that?
Yes, I did. Yeah, yeah, which was the Bush.
Yeah. He discovered Toast. Oh, it wasn't called Toast then, of course. It was called Wonderloaf, but, you know, whatever. And Jack Bradley, literary manager, and Graham Wybrow, literary manager of the Royal Court, had a meeting and decided that somebody should do this play, even though it was old-fashioned. And Richard Wilson came along, Victor Mildrey Richard Wilson, and he is... one of the artistic genres that he's quite committed to is, I think he uses a phrase sometimes like proper naturalism. He's often said, nobody does naturalism well. So we tried to do naturalism well with that play, and it was a good start, really. So very enjoyable work. I mean, in terms of quality of actors, you know, Sam Kelly, I suppose, was the most experienced and skilled.
And Sam Kelly's worked with you a couple of times since.
Yeah, I fell in love with Sam's just, you know, like genius isn't too grand a word for what Sam does, I don't think. Like, those people who work with him know what you can do with what looks like a very ordinary line on the page. Sam can spin it, you know, just turn it into golden.
And then you moved on, I was going to say moved upwards, but I'm not sure upwards necessarily. At what point did you decide that this was what you were going to do? Because you're no longer doing the day job, you're no longer being a stand-up comedian.
Yeah, it's interesting that, because after Toast finished, I was walking through Covent Garden, and Toast had finished the week before, and I was walking through Covent Garden, and I saw Richard Wilson coming towards me, and of course a famous person like Richard Wilson walking through Covent Garden, of course he had his baseball hat on pulled down over his eyes, and I was walking towards him, and I thought, oh well, you know, I'll try and make eye contact, say hello, and of course he just walked straight past me. And I thought, that's it, Richard, that's it, it's over. It was good while it lasted. How long did that last? It lasted 4 weeks. Great, okay, that was it, that was your career. He walked past me. Terrible. But what's next, I think, was your question. I suppose there was a relationship really with the National and the Royal Court simultaneously.
And when did you decide you could become a full time, or not do anything else at least? A full time play, that's the way of expressing it.
That's a tough one. I can't remember, to be honest. It must have been the year after Toast. I think a couple of television companies got interested in Toast for TV and started signing checks. They've never done it, of course, because television companies don't make things and broadcast things, do they? I don't know what they do. They seem to buy scripts and don't do anything with them. But anyway, that's my experience of television. Obviously, I write rubbish.
one might argue I'm rather too well for television.
Well, I'm glad you said that. I wouldn't dream of upsetting my.
You just fed me the line, yes.
Well, I don't know. I think yeah, I got a couple of checks from television who wasted my life by making me write television versions of Toast that they didn't do anything with. Can I have those 3 months back? Because I will give you the 20 grand back. So I think probably from then I've just about scratched a living.
And maybe a big step forward in terms of fame, if that's the right word, was Harvest.
Well, I don't think fame is...
You got the Critics' Circle Best Play Award, so in certain circles, suddenly gone from unknown to known, at least.
In certain circles, yes.
Well, in theatrical circles, that's
a good moment. Okay. Well, yeah, I know, but that's a certain size of pond, isn't it? I think there's a. Yeah, I'm not going to worry about that. Yeah, Harvest. Yeah, sure. Harvest was a great experience for me, and. Yes, I suppose it was a play which excited the critics in the sense that half of them loved it and half of them hated it. Well, actually, the half that hated it didn't hate the whole thing. They just hated Act 7, which was the final modern act. It's a seven-act play, anybody who doesn't know it out there. Seven-act play from, 1914 through to 2005, following the life of one man on a farm in East Yorkshire, pig farm in East Yorkshire, and burglars turn up in 2005, and it looks like they might rape the old age pensioner. They don't, and then the 109-year-old man shoots one of the burglars, and quite a few critics thought it was a completely ridiculous ending. But one of the great ironies, I suppose, is that Channel 4 loved it and commissioned a film of the whole thing, which obviously, again, being television, they didn't do.
But you got the checks, so
no, I got the checks. Yeah, it's not. I'm not interested in the checks. I want my life back. I want my time back.
Mm.
But the point I was trying to make was that they did make the Act 7. They filmed Act 7 and broadcast Act 7, so it was fascinating that 50% of the theatre critics really hated Act 7, but it was Act 7 that television loved and wanted to make into a film and actually did broadcast. So they broadcast a 20-minute version of Act 7.
Do you have views about the critics that you want to publicise at all? Because you've had a funny time with the critics, because there are some that absolutely love you, there are some that seem to struggle with you, there are some that love most things and then suddenly will decide they don't like a single play. Maybe that's just life. Maybe that happens with all playwrights.
I don't really know what I feel or think about the critics.
Do you read them?
Do I read them? That's a good question. Well, I'll tell you what, let's take an example and let's try and be completely truthful here, Richard. Because there's a temptation to be media friendly, isn't there? The Heretic, my last play at the Royal Court. Libby Purvis, she's kind of getting her reviews out first now, isn't she? There's a race for print between Michael Billington and Libby Purvis now, is that right?
There is. The slight problem with Libby Purvis is she's now only on paper as far as I'm concerned, so I'm not willing to shell out whatever it costs to subscribe to the Times online.
Oh, I see, yeah, there's a paywall, isn't there? Yeah. Well, anyway, Libby Purvis, there was one of the first reviews out, and you asked me, do I read the reviews? Mm. So I started reading the review, and it said, Act 1 is brilliant, it's the most stimulating, funny, whatever act you could ever act, a single act in a theatre that... however, in Act 2, and then I stopped reading. And that's actually a very typical way in which I suspect many writers approach their reviews. They're very happy to read anything that's positive about the play. But as soon as you get a whiff, I mean, it's a scent, that there's this paragraph might contain something that... is in some way derogatory about the play, then you just don't read it.
Strangely, actually, I wrote a review of a play last week, and the director got in touch with me, which was always an exciting prospect, and it was with a specific question to give him information. I made a constructive criticism to give him more detail about that so he can improve the play, which I was quite flattered by, actually. But I've had everything. I've had everything from hate, literally hate mail from artistic directors of companies, to praise. In fact, I had hate mail and praise from the same artistic director of the same company.
For different...
Different performances, different productions, so yes.
Yeah, it's a strange relationship we have, isn't it, with writers and critics. One does get a sense, I got a sense with Nicolas de Jong, for instance, that it was getting personal. And, you know, the tone of his language that he was using in his reviews of my plays became irrational and personal. And this is the only time I've done this. This is the only time I've really got involved with the critics. I would ring up the Evening Standard editor and point out any particular mistakes that were made within the review. And I wouldn't, you know, I'd make a point of finding inaccuracies in the review or something and ringing up and saying, you know, there was one particular one in the club, which was the farce that I have said that you quite enjoyed. But I remember you quite enjoyed that one.
Yes.
I think he absolutely hated it. I mean, I didn't read reviews. As I said, I can't read bad reviews. But my publisher got involved and wrote to him and said, I think Nicholas said something like, described it as manure. The play was manure. So my agent wrote to him and said, well, we don't publish manure or something like that. But in his review, he described a scene which we cut from the play.
This is why I'm not a national critic. This is why I'm not a national paper critic. I can't describe scenes like that.
Well, you see, this can happen because, of course, the published play text
It's different.
Is published a week before the play opens, and of course you're cutting all the time in rehearsals. And there was actually a scene which we'd cut, and he described it. Actions within a scene, I think it might be more accurate. So, I mean, I rang out the Evening Standard and said, this isn't on, I'm sorry, you're getting a call this my play manure and describe something that didn't happen, you know, that kind of... So, and I got a sense that it was becoming personal with Nicolas de Jong, and that's not a pleasant feeling, because I think we have a kind of symbiotic relationship, critics and writers. We tolerate you know
And vice versa.
We don't want to get too close. I mean, you know, there's one or two critics out there who generally, you know, we're a little bit of like mind, if you like. I mean, you know, and that obviously works. But even then, you've got to kind of manage the relationship, I think. And that's how it's got to be, isn't it? You know, I can be very civil to you, but if you give me a poor review for a poor play, or what you consider to be a poor play, I'll still be civil to you. Michael Billington's a very good example. My relationship with Michael Billington is very friendly. It's not deep, it's friendly. I will always say hello, Michael, and shake hands and do small talk chat and whatever. And he was very tough on England people, very nice, for instance. And in my estimation, he misunderstood it. He didn't get it. He didn't understand it. But I'm not going to fall out with him. I think he's a decent man, and I think he's a thinking man, and he's analytical, and he demands a lot from playwrights, and you just got to forgive and move on. He doesn't.
In your particular case, the moving on is probably easier because you're so prolific that the next one is queuing up as the last one finishes.
I work hard, sure.
But you're also successful because you work hard at plays that do well enough to sell and get on to big stages these days.
Well, this word prolific, what does it mean? What does prolific mean? I'm not writing any more plays than anybody else, you know, I don't think. Am I? Getting them on, maybe.
You and David Gregg are the people who seem to me to have more plays in a year than produced in a year than other people.
Yeah, well, I don't think produced, Dan. Well, you've got, let's get specific on the semantics. I think most playwrights are writing all the time. You know, it might be,
and it may also be because you concentrate more on theatre, and therefore it could be that they're writing episodes of Thrill and Casualty.
No, that's absolutely true. That's a very good point to make. I hadn't even thought about that. Yeah, you're right. Because no, absolutely right. Especially younger playwrights, actually, because there's a lot of television which is aimed at a younger market than, well, my age group anyway. Thinking of Skins and all those kind of.
And you've got someone like Jack Thorne is going to be writing that rather than
now,
writing
Jack,
the stage.
For instance, Jack could be writing three plays a year, but of course he'll be doing. And good on him, because if you're young
and you've got a mortgage, or you want to get a mortgage, then you want more than.
Or possibly even want to make so much money you don't need a mortgage.
Well, quite, yeah. But if you're young, you're always going to be tempted by money, aren't you? A play at the Bush isn't going to. Get you on the housing ladder, is it?
Not too far up it anyway.
No.
Just to wind up, I shall remind you and remind everybody, you don't need to know, that One Man, Two Governors is opening at the National Theatre next week. Have you got other plays in the pipeline that we're allowed to know about yet?
Well, I don't mind talking about it. I've got a commission with Out of Joint, Max Stafford Clark, to write a play called Pitcairn. Pitcairn, essentially based on the history of Pitcairn Island, which is obviously, as everybody knows, is where the Bounty mutineers went to live in an attempt. Well, it's actually incorrect to say in an attempt to set up Arcadia, because basically they were just trying to hide.
Yes. Hide. Once they got there.
Hide from the British Navy, who sent ships out to try and find them in order to execute them, of course. But they found Pitcairn, which had been mismapped. What's the right word? The maps were wrong. So the British Navy were looking for Pitcairn, couldn't find it. But the mutineers had discovered that it was 200 miles south of what the British Navy map said it was. So it was the absolute perfect.
It didn't exist.
Hiding place. It didn't exist, essentially. And they'd found it. And that was Fletcher Christian's genius that. Did that, but basically the play is they went to Tahiti. They're all male, of course, the mutineers. So they went to Tahiti and press ganged, is probably the right word, 12 Tahitian women and 5 Tahitian men to be slaves, and went to Pitcairn to set up a new community. And 6 years later, there was one man standing. They kind of basically killed each other in a series of feuds and whatever, but it's a really let me try and sum it up in one sentence. Lord of the Flies for grown-ups, if you like.
I can't wait to see Lord of the Flies for grown-ups. Richard Bean, thank you so much. That's been wonderful.
Yeah, it's been great. Thanks, Phil.